David Roberts, student inductor graduate course. To interview Dr. Homer E. Nash, 982 Simpson Street, Northwest. Time, 5 o'clock. Date, July 8, 1973. Dr. Homer Nash is a practicing physician.
Wait just a minute, I'm turning.
Yes, I am.
Dr. Nash, you tell me something about your early life.
I was born in Greene County, down in White Plains, Georgia. May 6, 1887. My parents moved from there when I was less than 3 months old to Athens. And that's where I read.
You went to school there?
I went to school there. And finished high school. I did well to get out of high school in those days because it was difficult. Negroes wouldn't help you, white people wouldn't help you. They'd tell you, work your way. They had the old Booker Washington idea, work your way through school. So I was a delicate kind of a child, and I did the very best I could, but it wasn't too good, pretty hard. But I finished at the top of my class in the high school in Athens in 1906.
Was there any specific examples of discrimination in Athens, Georgia, towards you?
Plenty of them, towards Negroes. I was a Negro, they wasn't there towards me, but specifically.
Well, what were they?
Well, first place, they didn't give you the facilities in your school that they had in the white school. They didn't give you teachers as much salary for teaching you as they gave the white teachers. Your school was inferior in its built to what the white teachers' school was. In other words, it's just a matter of, let's do something for Jim down there. And that's what it is.
Did that, how did it affect you in your school? Or your travel in the community, anything? How did these laws affect you, these Jim Crow laws?
They were everywhere. You had to travel in the Negro community. That is, unless you worked for Mr. Ed, you could be a butler, a chauffeur, and look after his horses or something like that. But, or you could, when I was a child coming along, the highest thing that I saw Negro hair would be get to be a mail carrier at Athens, or get to be a preacher or a teacher. That was it. I didn't want to be any of that.
When you were growing up, was there any lynchings in?
Right down at Watkinsville, just joining county, old Coney County, joining it. I just scared me to death. Some Negroes, I didn't know them, never saw them. They said they did something down there. I forget that they raped a white woman, four of them. They put some, nailed up four posts in the ground and tied four Negroes to those posts and shot them to death in the daytime. It was a terrible thing.
For everybody to see it.
Oh, everybody, man, didn't have nothing to hide. Everybody could see it, and this, and then the news spread everywhere.
Is that another example of lynching?
Yes, but I wasn't there at that time. It happens. Athens is possibly the most peaceful place, racially, around in that neck of the woods, because it was the center of Georgia education, the university located there, and they had more intelligent white people there in the university system. But in spite of that, a Negro did something in the adjoining county down there. They brought him back. So I wasn't down there. That's been 20 years ago, I guess. I was here. But they brought this Negro to Clark County, and Clark County had just built a new jail, old 7 stories high. And they put this Negro in there for safekeeping. That mob came up from that county and automobiles just crowded up, raising the devil, trying to make Sheriff Jackson, who happened to be the man as sheriff at that time, to turn this Negro over to him. They said he wouldn't do it for a period of 2 or 3 days. They were raising the devil night and day for those 2 or 3 days. And he finally gave him the key or put it where they could find it. Or anyway, they went up in the jail and got this Negro and carried him down. It was just like a great triumph. Just hooping, went on back with him down in that county. Then tied him up, I'm told, I wasn't there. Tied him up to a tree, cut his privates out and rammed them in his mouth, built a fire under him, and let him take a slow death.
You remember what year that was?
No, I don't.
That's quite.
That was happening then. At the meantime, in that time, the National Association for Advancement of Colored People was having the time of their lives trying to get some legislation against lynching through the Congress of the United States. And there's so many, now those are known things, but so many Negroes have been found tied in the river. Great big iron thing tied to them, ready to drown them, jump them off.
Did you ever see the Ku Klux Klans out in Athens? Or
no.
You never did. They didn't come out. If it was anything was done, they just lynched them.
Well, the mob would lynch them, but they didn't identify. Those that I heard about, they didn't identify themselves as the Ku Klux.
Is there anything, any other incidents you would like to talk about?
I don't remember any others, not around that.
Did you go to one of the local colleges here?
No, I didn't.
Where'd you go to school?
I finished high school at Athens in 1906. And at that time, medical college, if you finish high enough in your class, the medical college would take you.
What medical school you go to?
Higher medical college. And Howard University, both of them. I got accepted, but I couldn't handle money to go where to Washington. And so I went to Meharry. I was accepted there. And
what year you finished there?
1910.
You left Meharry and came to Atlanta.
Yeah, I left my hair and went back to Athens.
Did you
study for the examination, the medical examination? You have to pass the examination if you get a license to practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And when I got back here, I passed this examination, and I was just like a man between two extremities, between the river and a great precipice. Yeah, I had no money. I borrowed the money to take the examination. Somebody had enough faith to let me have $15, I believe, to pay back in those days to take it. And I went in to take this examination. I was just shaking like a leaf because I had no money. I couldn't afford to fail. I had to pass. And I was so worried about it as a student, because all of them are. And they could take that examination, because so much hangs on it. I was laying in bed, and I studied way in the night, every night, for nearly a month preceding examination. And I was wondering what in the world he can ask. And something woke me up in the middle of the night. We burned an oil lamp, and I'm like that too. Went to oil lamps. I jumped up. What is opium? Heard it just as distinct as that. I hopped up, got my material and everything, and read that thing. Opium is a milky concrete exudate obtained by incising the unripe capsules of the Pavius omnifera, containing in its normal moist condition not less than 9% of crystallized massive morphine when assayed in Dignus in Asia, Northern Africa, and China. Now, that's exactly it. I remembered it to the day.
And that question was on the test.
When the first question on material medical, what is opium? And it was just like unlocking a door. After that, I knew it so well, I guess my confidence built up. I was writing that thing, and all those white boys in there was just worrying the professor to death about what is this, the man who's monitoring the class. What is this? What do you mean by this? I didn't ask him anything. I wrote it and then went out there and waited an hour and three quarters of an hour. for them to get through, so we started the next one. So they came out there after I'd been out there about just out there in the hole by myself waiting in about 3/4 of an hour, another one to come out, and another said, "Did you answer all those questions?" I said, "Yeah, one of them. May not be right, but I answered." So he said, they said, "Well, I wish I was like you." I said, "No, what do you want to be like me for? I'm at disadvantage." He said, "No, Professor Golden says that while he's waiting for us to get through with the examination, he thought he'd look and see what you had written. And he said that you're all out here asking all those questions. That colored doctor's made 90 on this paper here, and you're out there, and you here asking me this, that, and the other." Well, I was right or wrong. I felt better when he said that. I know he might have been just goofing me or he might not. I didn't know. But at any rate, that it was like that in all the other examinations. Well, it looked like my hand was like, I put on paper fast, my hand could move. But that looked like it seemed to have been the key. And it came to me in a dream. And I hopped up in a lit an oil lamp and read it, for memorized it, and just exactly that's it. And that was 63 years ago.
Did was any discrimination shown when you was taking the exam, anything?
No, we were all in the Senate chamber, sitting in those different desks, the man was looking at everybody, and so forth. And so I wouldn't say discriminating. In fact, I thought they were very fair, because I'll tell you, the trustees of Meharry Medical College had a rule that any student that owes any money cannot leave the college with his diploma. Well, this student owed $53. And there was no way you have a diploma. When you go take the board, you got to have a diploma. I didn't have one. But the secretary lived at Athens, Dr. Gauss. I knew him. So I went there and I told him exactly the truth. And in the meantime, I went to the dean's office. I didn't march with my class because I was so embarrassed. I went next morning after they graduated, I went to the dean's office and told him, "I'm sorry I don't have the money, but the first money I make, I'm going to send it back here to you for that I owe you." I said, "You give me a letter stating the facts why I don't have my diploma and that I have completed the work. I believe I can get the examination." He did just that. He gave me a letter, and I did. I finished second in my class. 1910, we had a class of about 66. And so I took this letter and took it up to Dr. Gauss and let him see it. He said, "Yes, you can, you can take the examination." And so I was so poor. So when I walked up to the old secretary, old man from way down here in South Georgia, the secretary was a guy that registered everybody. He was on the board of a medical examiner. "Is that your diploma?" Dr. Gauss said, "Register." And that's all that did it. I wrote in, he registered me and give me an envelope with my name on it, Dr. Homer E. Nash, Athens, Georgia. And then put in the envelope, give me a number, there's a number on that, and seal it up. Now that was way back there in those days. The man that checked your paper didn't know whether you were black or white until he went to get this number.
What was student life like in Meharry?
Student life was very good, very competitive. Very competitive. But everybody wanted to graduate because there were a lot of poor boys like myself in there. Such a thing as a scholarship or a grant.
Unheard of.
Oh man, I was telling some youngsters in my office the other day, you living in a clover bed and don't know it. All these grants, all these fellowships, and all. I said, and furthermore, that it was this state of Georgia that has never done right by the Negro. Even here, you can get your education completely financed. Just furnish the brain.
That's right.
You just furnish the brain. They'll completely pay it at Meharry, Harvard, Yale, anywhere, if you furnish the brain.
When you came to Atlanta in 1910, I think 1903, Georgia had disenfranchised the blacks. How were black
people treated here in the courts?
Oh, man, in the courts as I see it here in Atlanta, all you have to do, you want to get a verdict against you, just be black.
Just be black?
Yeah, just being black.
Did they address you with any courtesy as Mr. Dr.
Hall? No, I never been there, been down there as a doctor. But you, John, George, Boy, all that kind of stuff.
No respect.
Oh, no, I go down to the police school. You niggas, all you niggas over there, keep quiet. It would be a big case where there's maybe a little police school in there. Y'all sit down there and do this, hush up. And that's a little guy that catered, the white guy that's running around there just a shade above a janitor.
Right.
That's keeping everybody, he's supposed to be keeping God on the beds and keeping everybody quiet. And the Negroes didn't have it. There was no way they could get overcome that right then. But it won't happen today.
You wasn't here in 1906.
No, that's when the riot was on. I was in Nashville.
Nashville. Was there any reaction in Nashville to this?
Oh, yeah, all over the country.
What was it in Nashville?
Everybody was angry about it.
The blacks were?
Oh, yeah. They were angry about it. They knew it had to be unjust. There wasn't anything fair about it.
Did the whites get mean or anything in the community in Nashville, or did
no,
they react?
We had very little contact with the whites in Nashville when I was in school there. But when I came back to Atlanta, we had a paper here called the Georgia. It had three. It had Atlanta Journal, Atlanta Constitution, and Atlanta Georgia. This Georgia was just as anti-Negro as it could be. And so that in 1924, we Negroes, the poorest segment of the population, didn't have one high school since his childhood. Atlanta University had a high school, Marsh Brown had one, Clark had one, Spelman had one, and then if you sent your child to high school, you had to pay for it. So that in 1924, the white man came, they wanted to varnish it. They wanted five or six white schools. They needed them. And the Negroes wanted one. And that was in 22. They came down and we had a big rallying point at Bethel Church in the basement there. Negroes piped in there like sardines in a can. We were in that tank. The cracker didn't want you to talk right to him, man, cheek to cheek. He wanted you to just say, yes, sir. And what you gonna give us now? Now you pass this varnish and then we'll talk about that later. Now don't be throwing a monkey wrench in the machine. And that's a millionaire in this town named Inman. Inman was a powerful man because he had lots of money. He, the Board of Education sent him down to talk to the Negroes. And Inman had another deacon dead and gone now named Deacon Harris of Wheat Street Baptist Church. That church going down with it. He wasn't in this new one. Oh, he had one of these high falsetto voices. He said, Mr. Inman, what the colored people want to know is what they're going to get out of this bond issue. Take your seat. You're throwing a monkey wrench into the machinery. We'll get past the bonds and then we'll decide. And he said, well, old Deacon Harris had to take a dig at him. He said, well, you know, you can't tell us what we're going to get. And I want to tell you that the bonds ain't going to pass. And they didn't. The varnish will fail. So they waited about probably 6 or 8 months. And they came down again. They had a man named Dykes. He was assistant superintendent of the public schools. He came down and a white woman, I forget her name now, but she came with him. She's a very influential and financially well-off woman. They came down to plead for the Negroes to pass the bond. And in those days, the automobile was just getting around, and Negroes were chief of the chauffeur. So now, hopefully, they show you how asinine people are. She says, I hope you all will pass this bond issue, because they're putting the viaduct across, that you see it running across now by Terminal Station,
yes.
Right on through that Spring Street viaduct. Wasn't up then. That cost $700,000. You couldn't build it for $5 million now, right where it is.
Right.
It'll make it better for the colored chauffeurs that have to drive these cars across there, and I hope you'll pass it. He wasn't thinking about it, just listening to her. This Dykes. Oh, he was so anti-Negro, he got up there and talked about, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We'll give you a junior high school, and that's all we go. That's Floyd, that's Fury. That's Floyd, you can go. See a fellow down there black in your shoes. He's the pastor of Wheat Street Baptist Church. His name's Peter James Brown. He got up to talk to Mr. Dykes. He said, Mr. Dykes, we have done without high school all these years. We've scuffled under God, eternal mercy, to educate our children through the high school. Without this help of the city of Atlanta, and I want to tell you here tonight that unless we get assurances that we're going to have, and he had a string of adjectives this long, he was great on English language. Unless we get a genuine, Simon Pure, shown up to date, last minute, he had a string of adjectives this long, high school. We are not going to vote for those bonds. We are not going to hang another rope around our necks. We've had it around there long enough. We've done without it this long, we can do without it from now on. White people dying, they needed these schools. See, the white population is increasing. So he tried to say, well, now, I wouldn't be that extreme about it and so forth. But they left that night, and there was the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, named a man L.K. Williams. And his son-in-law, M.L. King, came in there long after he, long years later. He got up there and he always had a little host meeting after all these white folks gone, and the Negroes, the leaders got up there. He said, when you get down there and when you go to vote tomorrow, you go down there where them school bonds just smote it. He said, I'm gonna smote it. That's just his exact word. When you get to the cyclorama, the one they're talking about moving downtown,
right,
uptown, smote it. They wanted $100,000 so that niggas couldn't get one school. And they had a list of schools, smite all of them. They did just that. That was the third time. But the bond didn't pay it. Then this paper, I'm telling you, they were so anti-Negro, Atlanta, Georgia, owned by William Randolph Hearst. He had a string of papers up the country down there, and in Atlanta. That paper came out and said that the bourbon whites, and I forgot they had some very ugly adjective about Negroes, joined forces, and killed the Varnish. And they said a whole lot about it. Well, the Negroes met and decided that since we killed the Varnish, we ought to finish it by killing the Georgia. And then the whites killed the Georgian. They had to go. And it's been going ever since.
They stopped buying the Georgian paper.
Stopped the Georgian, just stopped trading with anybody that advertised in it. Trading with anybody that advertised in it. Not only stopped taking it. It came on then until a real redneck cracker became mayor of the city of Atlanta named James L. Key. James L. Key became the mayor. We helped put him in. We were voting. And the city hall was right where Fulton National Bank is now. If you know where that is.
I know where it is.
Well, that was city hall proper there. But it wasn't a tall building like it. It wasn't two stories tall. Been there for long. They sold that property and they moved the city hall right where it is now, down there on Mitchell Street. And old man Key was so proud when he built that building that he had his chest all stuck out. He came downstairs one morning and looked around, and over there it had elevators for Negroes, baggage, and freight. He called the custodian right there, right on that first floor, that day. He said, who put that sign up there? He declared he didn't know who put it up there, how it got. He said, well, I, James L. Key, mayor of the city of Atlanta, order you to take it down and never put it up there again.
What year was that?
That was 19, I'd have to look up the year that
That's
he,
all right.
he was elected.
That's all right.
He took it down. That was the first building desegregated in the city of Atlanta. One man desegregated the city hall. He used to have to go to give in your tax for them to spend, and you had no voice over it. But you had to be in this line over here. And white man, that line over there. He broke that up. One man, and a cracker too. You got in the line and said, carried your initials. That the A to B is in this line, or B to C is in that line. Your name's in them line. You get in the line with it. So that did away with the segregated line. And that's where you're giving your tax.
Anything else he did?
Yes, and I'm gonna tell you about this barn issue.
Go ahead.
On about Keith. And the last time, he came down to the church about this barn issue. The Negroes are mad, buzzing like bees. Ooh, you couldn't. He got up there and said, now wait a minute. Let's understand one another. Said, I, James L. Keith, mayor of the city of Atlanta, challenge anybody here tonight to stand up and say that I ever promised the colored people anything and didn't live up to it. I want to get that clear. Now, if I've done that, stand up. Nobody stood up. Everything quieted down. He says, you didn't have a library. That was the truth. You didn't have a library where you could go and sit and feel comfortable. I made them buy the land on Auburn Avenue. He did, on Auburn and Hill. They bought me a little spot there, wasn't big enough to put a chicken coop on. I vetoed it and made them get it large. I got all the land I could get, made it large, and put your library on it. He says that they raised the teacher's salary. The council passed, they did just that. They passed it, they passed it three times. Negro teachers raised the Negro teachers 5%. White teachers 10%. He said, I vetoed it till they raised teachers 10%. They did. And said, Washington Park out here, you didn't have nowhere you could take your children, sit down comfortably and enjoy the shade, and where they could bathe in a pool or anything, you didn't have anywhere. I bought 16 acres out there and we named it Washington Park, and I've added to it every year that we could. I had it high on the agenda. And then both planned to make the prison Washington Park. And he had so many other things he told he had done. One man. He said, now, I, James L. Keith, promised the colored people of the city of Atlanta, if you go out tomorrow and vote these bonds, you shall have a genuine, all that Peter James Bryan told him about this high school. You know, not only that, you shall have five elementary schools. New ones, and they are there now. Where over here, Houston, one over on Howard on Houston Street, one in Krogman out down in Pittsburgh, another one out here on Martin Street, what's that name, Johnson, J.P. Johnson, I believe.
Right.
We got about five, all them buildings going up.
Plus a high school.
Huh?
Plus a high school.
Yeah, plus Washington High. You know where Washington High is?
Right. Yeah.
Well, he bought all that land. That at that time, that was virtually in the country. And Negroes, some of the Negroes were short-sighted, complained because he didn't buy them the land down in the heart of the city. Well, where the city hall is, was the Goods High School. They sold that land to the city and moved the Goods High School way out yonder. And they moved the Boys High School from up there by the city auditorium way out yonder. And they put Washington High School in. From that on, we have come along. But James L. Keith was the one man. So he was so proud of himself. He went to France. Then the prohibitionists were very bad here in those days. Oh, it smelled, if you drink a drop of liquor, you just what the devil ought to have it. That's what they had in mind. So he went to France and he saw the Frenchman sitting out on the sidewalk drinking in the evening, drinking that champagne. It's a part of France, part of the life of France. And he said that he wrote in the newspaper, he didn't see anybody drunk or disorderly doing anything. These guys got themselves 10,000 names. to recall him. By the time he could get back here to his office, they had that list of 10,000 to recall the man. Over yonder, indulging in breaking the prohibition law. All right? They had the election. 6,000 Negroes made the difference. He stayed right in there, and the only reason that he left, he was out of there, death. You couldn't beat him.
Was there any other mayor that was, attitude was good towards blacks here?
One we made, Hartsfield.
Was it? Is there any other back behind Hartsfield?
He would do things for the city. He was a doer. But I didn't know, I wasn't very well acquainted with him. The man named Hartsfield, for which the airport is named, he was mayor here for 20 years. And at first, when he ran, he was beaten. He was anti-Negro.
Hartsfield used to be anti-Negro?
Yeah, used to be anti-Negro. But he came over on the other side, and he tried to do things to help Negroes and to help them, and it was very difficult. If he had wanted to stay in there, it had been very difficult to get him out, because he became progressive, got over on the right side. But he was anti-Negro when he was in the council.
Medical facilities for blacks here when you started your practice?
Poor. Great hospital itself was very poor. And that was the chief thing for poor people. They didn't have money. And they don't have money to pay the fees in these hospitals they got now. They got more hospitals than you need.
Well, how did they treat blacks when they went to Grady?
Well, Grady Hospital was under Atlanta Medical College jurisdiction. Atlanta Medical College at that time was on Butler Street, right across the street from Grady. And of course, they, with the professors and their students, they put the Negroes in two little wooden things that run along there, long wooden things, what called a ward. And they'd get over there by and by to see about the Negroes in these two wooden wards. But I'm saying, instead of treating everybody as a human being, as a citizen, as a person entitled to the very best of the city of Atlanta, they wasn't thinking about doing that.
Not for blacks?
No. They didn't do it then. They ain't doing it. Wasn't doing too much for whites. I'm telling you.
Did you ever see the Ku Klux Klans out here in Atlanta at any time? Have you ever seen them parade here in Atlanta?
I never saw them parade, but I did see them standing in front of the Catholic Church with their hoods and things on.
You recall what year?
No, I don't recall.
That's all right.
But I saw them standing out there because they didn't want Negroes going in there worshiping with white people. See, the Catholics, the Lady of Lourdes, Corner Boulevard and Auburn, but it's just right near. Between Boulevard and Edgewood, it's on Boulevard between Auburn and Edgewood. Mm-hmm. It's there now. And of course, mainly its membership is black, but they have a lot of white people in there too.
You remember when blacks couldn't vote in the Democratic primary?
Oh, yeah. I remember the grandfather clause and all those things.
How did the blacks here break down the Democrat, the white primary?
The Constitution of the United States broke it down.
Did you have to file a suit or anything?
The NAACP did.
They filed a suit?
They filed. And then besides, when it comes to getting the presidency now, who believed in civil rights, you commenced to get them somewhere.
Well,
one of the great men that blessed Negro, I don't care how much white people curse him, is a Southern, deep Southern. And that man is Lyndon Johnson, dead and gone, one of the best humanitarians that ever sat in the president's chair, Lyndon Johnson. Another one, Southern, Harry Truman. Harry Truman did more. He was right on it. Now, when he got in there, looked around, I went to World War I. I wasn't in World War II. My son's in World War II. Negro soldier get sick or injured or anything, he had to go to Tuskegee. And that hospital 48 right out here, you know, he had to go way on down to Tuskegee. The discrimination was so bad when he's fighting for the same country. So Harry Truman said he wasn't going to have no two armies. And he wasn't going to have any two hospitals. An American soldier was just an American soldier. And if you had need for hospitalization, wherever the United States had a hospital, it had to be open to him. And wherever they had the army, the Negro had to be integrated in it. All these other presidents had carried on that foolishness of having the 24th and 25th Infantry, and then send them into hell hole and let them all get killed up by themselves and everything, call them brave and all that kind of stuff. Harry Truman broke it up, integrated them in the army, and so you don't have any black unit.
Well, during World War I, was there any, the army was segregated during World War I, right?
Oh, it was segregated to death. And in my unit, I was a lieutenant, and the Field Hospital 366 of the United States Army came out, captain, high as you could get, that was the ceiling. Bump your head right up there.
Was that for blacks or whites?
That blacks. One Negro in there named Major Ward from Indianapolis. It was a major. And everybody else was down. It was anything, officer. It was from lieutenant to captain. That was old. And back then, when I came out in 1919. That's right. It was terrible. But,
Were there any other instances of segregation in World War I?
Well, it's hard to find it where they had your reins.
Mm-hmm.
You were all in a Negro unit. And the Negroes, of course, weren't segregating themselves.
Right.
And so there was no white.
How did all the troops treat you when they said?
Oh, they do that.
The white troops treat you.
Well, old General Leonard Wood started that at Camp Funston, that way we trained in Kansas. And then all the rednecks from these southern states didn't want to salute a Negro if he's a general. Well, didn't want to salute when you passed. So Leonard Wood had them all by that assembly in Camp Funston, Kansas, in the assembly hall. And all because we trained down there, the trains for the 92nd Division and the 89th Division, of which he was a general. Trained there. So he had all of us in that big assembly. And he had that soldier standing up there. And then he went, he delivered his lecture. He said, it doesn't matter who has this uniform on, and you pass him and don't salute, you are in contempt of army regulations. I want that man plainly stood. Let me repeat. Wherever this uniform, identifiable uniform, see you got your chevrons and everything, and you fail to do it, you're in contempt of army regulations and you'll be court-martialed for it. Now I want to make that crystal clear. Well, that was down there. Those rascals walked right by the Negro officers who wouldn't want to salute. But believe me, after that, and yeah, they broke their arms off. And it's been that way all the time, where you get these bad treatments, it's from the top.
Right.
Not from the bottom, it's from the top. And so Leonard Wood did that.
Well, when you were over, what'd you go overseas?
We were in France.
Were you ever victimized by the whites who had gone over there and said that they didn't treat blacks the way that
the Frenchmen were treating them here in the United States, you had to treat them a certain way to keep them in the place.
Well, some of them are dead, dead told those folks that. And some of them are silly enough to believe it. But it didn't make any difference. We weren't dependent on them for anything, the French for anything. But, they look at you and say, oh, say, no, no, dark. Sole, sole. The sun made it, that made you dark. That's all it is. In other words, color prejudice. Color prejudice. And yet, those Cingalese soldiers, black as I am, they had regiments of, it's put those knives in that great long thing. And I mean, they go into battle and they got results. If he got to you, you a dead man. They're under the French too, from Senegal. And, the French on the whole had an idea of trying to be halfway decent. They had an idea of trying to be. But down in their heart of hearts, they've been so indoctrinated by these whites to go and tell them this, that, and the other. And they don't live over here, they have to take his word for it. But now, at that little hospital, I laughed at the incident that happened. I was in charge of the receiving and evacuation in Field Hospital 366 at Passavant. In France, just 40 miles behind the lines. The Germans used to roll them beat. I went to out on the railroad tracks and shell us every day, 4 o'clock. Get that thing in, and in less than 10 seconds, they get that shell, great big shell, big and iron, whistling over and dropped them, knock holes all around the hospital, didn't hit it. But that's all around, every. Well, this fellow came up from South Carolina, a little second lieutenant, and we'd been having trouble with the Germans. Killing Negro soldiers and shooting them. They have a spring hospital sitting here, and right down the foot of the hill is a spring. French get water down there and everything. The soldiers go down there and get that nice cool water. They didn't have no ice up there in that place. So the Germans slipped some of their sharpshooters in the trees in the night. They're getting it way up in the tree and sit up there all day and wait for these Negro soldiers to come down to get water and then shoot them. Well, it went on so that the general ordered 3 or 4 of those Negro sharpshooters in the tree. They went down there and went up in the tree. And they said, bring him dead or alive, get him. So one evening, the soldiers went down there and drank water. The guy shot at him. He missed him, but he located himself. At the sound of that bullet, so those sharpshooters hit him. Great big guy, and that was 7 feet tall, came tumbling out of that tree down on the ground. He was an Alsatian from Alsace. I mean, he was not Alsatian soldier, so they brought him into the hospital. I looked at him and see what we could do for him. And while I was appraising him, but we don't mistreat you when we get you. We get all the information out of you, but we don't try to kill you once we get your hands on you. But this little guy from South Carolina, second lieutenant, just assigned and just got right, went over and grabbed the man's hat off and grabbed some of his trinkets off his uniform, and the guy was hollering, don't need more this, give me this. I told the lieutenant, I said, Lieutenant, you can't rob the man. He said, oh, he's a damn Bosch, this, that, and that, been fed with that stuff over here. I said, but we don't do that to a soldier once we get him. And we don't do that. Said, if we do that to those that we ain't got our hands on. He says, I said, now you have to give him back. No, I'm going to carry these home for them. I'm carry these in the trinket. Well, the commanding officer of that hospital was a major who tried to be fair. I just wrote out a report and told him this man had just robbed this man on the table in front of us all, and would not return his belongings. I told him what we do with that soldier when he come. We find out all his name, where he is, the name of his people, and then all this stuff we put in a duffel bag, a little black duffel bag we had in those days, tied up, and that's for his people when they come. Well, That commanding officer, get to the end of my story. Ordered that fellow on the truck right on back to South Carolina that same day. Now that's the way they tried to do it. You just couldn't come up and do wrong.
Well, I had a governor here who was mean to Negroes during your time, 19.
Oh, my goodness. You'll never forget Hope Smith. He was one of those that espoused these segregation laws and the grandfather clause. Your grandfather didn't fight in such a war, you can't ever raise him. And there's several of them. And terrible. And governors of the state.
The attitude was bad, as
bad,
Hope Smith especially.
Bad. Hope Smith was an outstanding one, but there's several of them before him and after him. Bad.
Talmadge.
The old man, Eugene Talmadge, bad. And his son was one that ran off at the mouth and talked about what he's going to do to get in office. He got in, but he didn't do it. They asked him when he elected to Congress, why he didn't put in those. He said he wasn't going to have those Eastern papers ripping him to pieces. And so he tried to modify his position. In other words, they had him down at the Hungry Club. I know whether you heard about it or not. But they do have a Hungry Club at the Butler Street Y, and they get the best speakers and people in authority to come down and give talks on, I believe it's on Wednesday. I believe it's Wednesday every week. So they had Thomas down here, yeah, that's about 2 years ago. And they had him this year. They have him, and they've had him the last 3 or 4 years. But one fellow, Negro, who stuck his neck way out. They thought he was hitting them, getting town, embarrassing town. Asked him, well, Governor, Senator, why haven't you been among us before now? He said, well, I haven't been invited. And the people laughed. Now, he thought he was hitting him, and he got hit. The crowd just hooped and hollered and jeered. Man, you couldn't come down there and you didn't invite him. He came when he was invited. He had no record of where he refused to come, was invited and refused to come. The first time he was invited, he came.
Do you ever recall blacks being intimidated here in Atlanta when they tried to vote anything?
Not since the voting law has been in.
I mean from 1910, 20, 30, 40. Were there any intimidation against them when they tried to vote?
Well, they had the grandfather clause. All those things that blocked it out made it impossible for you. Vote, your name wasn't down there, so you went down to vote. You couldn't vote because your name wasn't on that thing.
Since you've been practicing medicine, have you been discriminated against in any way by any kind of medical association or anything?
No, in 1963, I made application to Fulton County Medical Society. They didn't want me in there to begin with. They didn't want any Negro. And they voted us out. They voted us out 3 times, and the fourth time, we won. Now, the way they do it, they don't get in the meeting and say, a house full of, they got more than 2,500 members, say, now, all in favor or do this or that. They don't do it that way. None of their votes. What they do, the proposition is before them. They write you a letter and put a card in there, and you sign it, yes or no. And send it to him, to every individual member. So we won it, right? And so I've been in there since 63. In 63, when I went in there, of course, they had never, that one big reason they didn't want you in there, besides being black, was they have dinner. And that day when the meeting, they have dinner from 6 to 7:30. Then their meeting starts. And they didn't want you eating dinner. They weren't used to eating dinner with Negroes. Well, when I went in, I said, I ought to be a full member if I'm going in. Yeah, I said, they'll try to embarrass me, I reckon, but I'll stand it. So I went in, I bought a dinner ticket. Get your dinner ticket for some kind of 60, it's about $16. It was about 18 or 20. That would be dinner for all the meals. But they have excellent meals. And I get mine and go over there and sit, get select me. And they got a whole dining room beat and tables right like this. There's tables everywhere. Have to be there. It's a big membership. So I go to a table where nobody's on because I know, I don't know who voted against me. And I don't know who voted for me. But I go select the table and sit down and eat my meal. I wouldn't care about that. But pretty soon they commenced to come in here. May we sit here? I said, have a seat. Be my guest. Have a seat. With the women doctors and the men. So they got to where now. They tell me, Dr. Nash, come over and join us. Now, it's actually that way last time I got there, last month. Come join us. And the month before, come join us. But it has taken a long time for it to grow like that. They found out that I wasn't exactly a bear and everything. And then we have a lot of doctors. I believe we got about 20 or 22 members who are members there, but there's about four or five of us that attend. But I go every month.
Is there any other experience you'd like to relate since you've been getting around?
Well, I don't know. There's so many things happen.
You remember Ben Davis?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I can't forget it.
What happened to Ben?
He went the way of all the folks that do like he did. He died unsung, unheard of. He's out there in Southview Cemetery. But he was a bulldozer. Everybody. Now there would be nobody from Ben lived, and I'm not lying on him. He had a little paper called Atlanta Independent. That was a Negro sheet. And he'd pick out, for instance, President Lyndon University, if you want to rip him up the back and say ugly things, and cool. You're doing that, Negroes buy that thing like hotcakes. Ooh, they want to get right there. And if it wasn't him, why some leading preacher, he'd rip him up, and that'd sell his paper. That would sell his paper.
Was he accused of being a communist?
No, not being himself, his son.
His son was?
His son was a communist.
No, he was a communist?
No, not that you, he was one. That's right. Ben was, called himself a black Republican.
But what was his son's name? Ben was
Davis Jr.
Mm-hmm. This is singing you was talking about who so had the paper and would rip people up if you want to.
When he was in power, he was terrible to the little folks.
I wonder what made his son become a communist.
I don't know to save my neck, because I know him from the time he was born until he died. I know him when he was in the public schools and when he was in college around there.
You think segregation caused him to be a communist? Or?
I don't think that.
You don't think so?
I don't think so.
It was just something he wanted.
He just wasn't going to adopt something, go do something new. I don't think so, because the communists, I don't know, but as I understand communism, I could never be a communist. They knock on the door late at night. You disappear just as if they just swallowed you up. Nobody knows where you are. A fair trial by court, gone. You just. I can't see it. I can't see it. Whatever you have belongs to the state, not you. You never own anything. So they tell me.
That's my understanding of it.
And I couldn't be a communist.
What about Henry McNeil Turner?
Oh, he was a bulldog. Now he was a guy that stood on his feet. When I was in medical school, I believe I was about 1908, something like that. He was holding a conference down here in Macon, Georgia. And he was talking about the United States. He said the United States flag is a dirty rag where the Negro is concerned. And he went on to explain, and the papers carried the headline, told his eye, I'm all over the nation. But old man Turner said that. And it's just been a battle for freedom all the time. they laugh at me and say, how can you be a Democrat? Oh, I say, I'm Democratic from my toes to the top of my head. Then, ever since Franklin Delano Roosevelt time, I say, the reason I believe in the Democratic Party, he said, think about it, those are the lynchers. They did this, they did that. I say, yes, I agree that all that did happen back there. But it happened because the Republicans that you like so let it happen. They were in the majority, they were in control. The Democrats hadn't been in power for years and years till Roosevelt came up.
Republicans stayed in about 20 years.
They stayed 20 years. I said, but you want to know why I'm a Democrat? I said, I look at it from the exact point of view. Like, what does the party do for my people? What did they do for me? I said, and it takes a Franklin Roosevelt, a Harry Truman, a John Kennedy, a Lyndon Johnson. It takes somebody like that to even know I'm in America. I said, I heard Lyndon Johnson say myself over the radio, telling how this man, one of the best lawyers in the nation, ain't no doubt about it, Thurgood Marshall, how Thurgood was appointed. He says he called Thurgood to his office and told him, I'm going to recommend you for the Supreme Court bench. But don't you tell anybody. I want you to come back over here tomorrow, but don't you tell anybody. Thurgood went home, chest nearly busting because he had to tell somebody. He did tell his wife. So the next day he went to Lyndon's office and he said, now you didn't tell nobody, did he? He said, now I must confess to you, sir. I did tell one person. Who was that? My wife. He said, well, you're forgiven. That's all right. I would expect you to tell her. And so forth. And that was Weaver. That the Kennedys had tried to put into a cabinet post, Congress wouldn't make it. But they were so indebted to Lyndon when he was in the House and when he was in the Senate. He told them to create that post. And they created it. And then they went and fixed the office up, get it ready. Got it ready. And they wanted to warn him to death. But who are you going to put in there? He said, just get it ready and we'll look around and we'll see who we're going to put in there. They put Weaver in. A man, he ought to send Ms. Marbley from New York office, from the NAACP office down here to make Atlanta step up this desegregating these schools. And she was excellent. I'm telling you, if there ever was a lawyer, she is one. She didn't get back to Washington, back to New York, before he appointed her a judge in Brooklyn. She's there right now. Lyndon Johnson appointed Harry Truman appointed, Alice's husband's name now, he's dead. But he was one of the first judges he appointed that looks after all this foreign property in the United States. He was the man. And so, when you look back at it, those are a few of the highlights and that the Democrats have done to help my people. What good does it do me to put a Republican in there and they do it? It's like Nixon. The highest office in it, so far as I'm concerned, before I've tried to investigate it, but the highest office I find to date is one where a Negro is secretary to the secretary to the secretary. I don't see one in a policy-making position, not one. And yet you've got Scott of the Atlanta World and Clayton Powell running around here who's been hard talking about somebody threatening him because he was in the Republican Party. Nobody's going to threaten you. We're just going to beat you at the poll. That's all we're going to do. And so therefore any of these politicians don't make no difference what their name is. That don't help my people. That I can't point out to my children. That's possible for you. See, it's a possibility. See, all these things. If he can do it, you can do it. It's, but under Nixon, nothing but Watergate. Nothing. And so, don't let me talk all you want.
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
so I'm not for the Republicans in there because McKinley never did anything for us. Taft never did anything for us. And several others never did anything in there, occupying that place. And some of them are very prejudiced. Been grieving upgrade Negroes. So Lyndon Johnson, more than anybody, convinced me that he wanted to be fair. I tell you what he did. In 1990, the National American Association met here on its 75th anniversary. I think we had 70 or 71. In 70, I believe, 1970. And they met in 1969 in Houston, Texas. You know that guy came over to Houston, Texas to visit the Negro National Medical Association and made a speech and everything? Lyndon Johnson. Never, if the thing 74 years old. Never had a thing like that before, have I? Never. But Lyndon Johnson. I used to be, I guess, prejudiced because of the environment I lived in. I didn't want a Southerner to do anything in high office. But I've changed around.
David Roberts, student inductor, graduate course.